The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to Slate's Audiobook Club for February 2018. I'm Laura Miller, Slate's books and culture columnist, and I'm your guest host holding down the book club fort. Today, I'm joined by Slate's Jacob Brogan.
Hello.
And by Charlie Jane Anders, a writer and commenter, the author of the Nebula Award-winning and Locus Award-winning novel, All the Birds in the Sky. Charlie Jane.
Hi. So good to be here.
Yes, we're all big fans of All the Birds in the Sky here. Okay, so today we will not be discussing All the Birds in the Sky, but maybe at some future date we will. Today we'll be discussing Ursula K. Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness, a novel about an emissary to an alien world trying to make connection with the inhabitants. This is a classic science fiction novel. It was published in 1969, and it really revolutionized the genre. It was really the first classic feminist science fiction novel. Let me ask each of you, because I think we all have, this is a reread for all of us. Mm-hmm. What was it like the first time you read this book? Jacob, why don't you start?
Sure. So I first read this book in a course taught by Hazel Carby 15 years ago on race and gender and, by implication, to some extent, sexuality in science fiction. I read it in the context of Samuel Delaney's novel from I think 6 or 7 years later, Trouble on Triton, which similarly is a science fiction novel that's trying to grapple with the plasticity of gender. At the time, I remember really fixating on those themes. But thinking back, I also really remembered it primarily as an adventure story. The part that stuck with me was those chapters near the end, a section of about 100 pages where Jen Lee I and Estraven are wandering across the frozen expanse and trying to make their way back to Carhide. But that's actually only about a third of the novel. And in fact, so much more of it deals with these themes of palace intrigue, with the politics of – is the word Shifgrethor? I don't know.
Shifgrethor, I believe it
Shifgrethor.
Is.
Sort of shadow etiquette of the people of Gethin. And it is a fascinating work of social world building. And that's really what I came away with from this time is the anthropological eye that Le Guin brings to the work of science fictional invention.
And how about you, Charlie Jane?
Yeah, I mean, I think I first read it also about 15 years ago, and I read it in the process of reading a bunch of Le Guin's novels from that era, and I remember kind of it running together with The Dispossessed and a couple of other books in my mind as these sort of examinations of societies and the meanings of different cultures and the kind of the difficulty of creating a just society. And that was sort of what stuck in my mind from 15 years ago. And when I reread it, you know, just now, I was really struck anew by all of the cultural meetings and all of the conversations between different societies that happen in it. But I was struck much more profoundly this time by how much I hated the character of Jen Lee I. In some ways, you know, the worst person in this book.
That's so funny.
Which hadn't really struck me previously.
Yeah, I can't remember being particularly... I can remember not warming to him that much. But, you know, for me, again, this was assigned to me when I was probably a freshman in like a rhetoric section or something like that. So it was completely new to me. And it blew my mind, which I think is what Le Guin intended to do. You know, she talked about how... You know, not only is it not a sort of straightforward action, you know, science fiction story with like this obvious antagonist or protagonist and, you know, moving along at a steady clip, but just this, the weirdness of the of having to think about people without genders. And in particular, I think, you know, there was some controversy over why she chose to use the masculine pronoun for the Gathenians. And for me, I think, just as that young reader who this stuff was so new to me, it was really powerful to have that male pronoun be used in all of these ways that I had not associated with that pronoun. It's like the book kind of keeps breaking that pronoun against itself over and over again.
Yeah, there are moments where Le Guin will say something like, when he was pregnant.
Yeah.
And just the casualness of that gender play that she enacts at a grammatical level is one of this book's subtlest, maybe most obvious, but still most striking accomplishments, I think.
Yeah, for me. Go ahead, Charlie.
But I actually take the male pronoun, like especially reading it this time around, I took the male pronoun as part of Genli I being a jerk. That he imposes that on everybody, and then he doesn't, and then he blames them for not being masculine enough. But we can talk about that more in a minute. I actually have a lot of thoughts about that.
Yeah,
There's a connection here to Ada Palmer's recent award-winning book, To Like the Lightning, where the protagonist in a kind of post-gendered society, in I think the 25th century, is similarly caught up in retrograde, like 20th century or 18th century even, notions of gender and insists on gendering people in ways that they would never gender themselves. And it creates in that book, even more self-consciously than here, I think, a really striking tension between the narrative focal character and the narrative more generally.
I think that he's sort of meant to be the reader surrogate, like maybe the guy that she imagines being the kind of typical science fiction reader of that time. And so she, you know, puts that person into this situation and then confronts him over and over again with the limits of his understanding.
I was really struck by how much this is the reverse of Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie, in which somebody visits someone who doesn't really understand gender the way that we do, visits a society of people with different genders and just decides to use the female pronoun for all of them because that's just most convenient. And so everybody in Ancillary Justice is a she, even if that's not the gender that they would have chosen. And so this is kind of the flip side of that, where I feel like at one point in the book, Genli I actually says that he just chooses to use the male pronoun for everybody because it's the default. And he actually says that.
The funny thing about that first reading, which just the experience of it was really one of the big, you know, mental explosions of my early college years, I did not remember the Arctic, you know, trek at all, where they're escaping from Orgeraine across this glacier, and it's like this fabulous Shackleton expedition thing that comes after all of this stuff where he's like, I can't say this to them, or he said this, and so that means this. And then all of a sudden it's like, no, we're out in the snow, and our breath is freezing, our nostrils shut, and you know, all of these things that she must have got from reading the sort of expedition notes of polar explorers. But I had completely forgotten that part, and I enjoyed it so much this time around. But apparently when I was 18 years old, it just was not that interesting to me.
Part of what really comes through as that section, that Arctic Trek section, proceeds is the degree to which a kind of tragic intimacy emerges between Genli and Estravan. This way in which they come to know one another, come to feel with and for one another in a way that is not sexual, that subverts Genli's expectations about how friendships and connections are formed. I guess, you know, it's possible to still come away from that not thinking very much of Genli, but he certainly does go on a personal journey over the course of that very real journey and become someone quite different by the end, I think.
He definitely starts out mistrusting and a little bit despising Estravan, and then by the end, there's just this feeling that if it weren't for his sense of duty, he would be flinging the gauntlet at the King of Carhide, for whom he blames, on whom he blames everything that Estevan has endured on behalf of his friend. So now, Charlie Jane, you talked a little bit about how with the second reading you had this different take on, you had a different, it sounds like your first reading was part of this whole sort of taking in all of Le Guin's many books in which she really used the genre to look at the sort of unchallenged assumptions about our own societies that we all have, and that anthropologists desire to compare them and find out what is constant and what is mutable in human nature. But what else did you notice besides in this reread, besides the fact that you didn't like Jen Lee too much?
I mean, just expanding on what I said about Jen Lee, I feel like his mistrust of Estevan is driven by his misogyny. And I think that he decides to gender everybody as male. He decides to use the male pronoun for everybody. And then he's constantly observing that people are being too effeminate and acting too much like women. And he doesn't like that. And anytime anybody acts too much like a woman, he is kind of turned off and upset. And he really hates women, and he's a misogynist. And so he brings this misogynistic filter to this planet where they don't have that concept of male and female. And his misogyny makes him bad at his job. Because he goes into all these situations where his views of gender are coloring it. And when people show what he considers to be excessively feminine approaches to a situation, he won't trust them or listen to them. It really struck me this time around that Estevan is trying his best to be straightforward with Jen Lee Ai. And yes, there's a cultural barrier to in the way of them understanding each other, but there's also just Jen Lee Ai is super prejudiced against him because of this idea that he's effeminate.
Yeah, he really is. And I think Le Guin had said, the other thing we should note about Jen Lee is that he is dark-skinned. Possibly he's what we would call a black man, but it's not really clear. Most of the people of Gethin seem to be pale-skinned, and they're constantly remarking on how dark his skin color is. And this is something that she did in many of her books. It was like her way of kind of tricking her readers into identifying with a character that was different from themselves, which is just based on, or not different from themselves, but because obviously many of the people who read science fiction are people of color, but the assumption that the protagonist is always white was something that she was constantly trying to undermine, both in The Wizard of Earthsea, whose main character is has the coloring of a Pacific Islander, which makes sense because they live on an archipelago, and with Jen Lee, you know, he's like the only person that we can sort of attach our traditional human gendered way of looking at things to, but he is different from the typical science fiction protagonist of the time. So she's even twisting that thing a little bit there. She said that she felt that the people of the future, that the action of this book takes place, might have gotten past their racial biases before they would get past their gender biases. She felt like that was more fundamental to human nature than racial bias.
I do wonder how much of that is about her own preoccupation with binaristic systems and ways of understanding the world. And she was, either of you may know more about this than I do, but as I understand it, she was a pretty serious Taoist.
Yeah, she was.
And her Taoism was at least partially in what we might call a sort of deconstructive mode in the sense that Jacques Derrida would have laid out that term, where male and female, dark and light, are always kind of imbricated in one another. They're co-constituting one another. They're impossible without one another. But they're even if they uphold one another, they're binaristic reality is still significant, and her sense of the binarism of gender is something that seems like she really wanted to work through and question and challenge, but it is striking that she would still see it as something that would linger in a society. And in fact, that she kind of funny that she would imagine the ecumen as this kind of quasi-civilization that on the one hand is like post-racial, but on the other hand would still, you know, not have the foresight to find someone who isn't a misogynist to send to send to a planet with these kind of different gender constructs than the rest of the planets they visited have. It seems a little short-sighted.
It's really remarkable that for someone who has basically accepted an assignment to go to this planet that, as far as he's concerned, has no women on it, he doesn't seem to miss women or sex, even though he seems to be pretty young. You know, right. It's odd that, you know, I would think, okay, what is he, in his 20s or something?
I don't know if we know.
I think at one point...
Yeah. I think there's a point when he kind of casually is like, oh, my parents have been dead for 100 years because of faster-than-light travel.
Yeah.
Where he does suggest that he's in his 20s or 30s, but I don't recall exactly.
Yeah, it just seems odd that it's not even an issue for him, that he's basically going to be celibate or you know, he doesn't seem to be attracted to men, he doesn't seem to be attracted to women, he just seems to be this sort of floating brain type character.
He's a weird dude.
Yeah, he really is. Jacob, what was there anything that struck you on rereading that, you know, you hadn't noticed before that really popped?
You know,
this
is going to sound crazy, but the thing that I really noticed this time is, and it's what a unbelievably marvelous writer Ursula K. Le Guin was. And I'd been thinking about that a little, you know, because she died quite recently. And so I've been rereading a lot of her work. And really no one put a sentence together like her, but the moment that really hit me was on like the second page, and it's this paragraph. It's just three sentences long. I'll read it. This is not an example of her at her most elaborate as a prose stylist, but it is so striking in terms of the way that she constructs the world of this book. I was in a parade. I walked just behind the gossowers and just before the king. It was raining. These two brief declarative sentences, I was in a parade and it was raining, sandwich this sentence in which something very strange happens just behind the gossowers, this figure of strangeness. She doesn't explain what a gossower is for several paragraphs. And just before the king, this recognizable thing, but still a thing that feels like it might come out of another time or another moment. That play of strangeness and sense or familiarity that she enacts at the sentence level throughout is so amazing. And I just – the level of craft that goes into sentences as simple as those three is just astonishing to me. And there are, of course, other beautiful, elaborate sentences as well. But just what a writer she is what I'm left with above all else.
I mean, that's definitely one of the challenges of writing a – science fiction that's like this, that's about encountering a different culture, is that so much, you know, like the names, how to pronounce the names, the different religions, the different foods, the different customs. This is a planet that's very cold. It's in the middle of an ice age. So there's a particular way that people live in Gethin that has to be explained. Like the amount of exposition is so, like, it's a lot to weight down a book with.
Did that level of exposition feel like too much to either of you, or did it come naturally?
I enjoyed it this time, but the first time, I think most of it just kind of went over my head. Like, I wasn't really able to take it all in. What about you, Charlie Jane?
I mean, I just loved the richness of the world building in general, and like the amount of thought that she puts into not just the politics, but the folklore and the kind of traditions of these people and how their kind of deep history intersects what's going on now, which is often the hardest part of world building to make work. She does it so deftly and effortlessly that it's really a joy to delve into all those little details that she puts in there.
As a novelist, are there things about this book that, you know, you really admire certain choices or touches or twists that you think, ah, oh, I should steal that, or, oh, I wish I had thought of that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always trying to steal from Le Guin, honestly. Yeah. Like, it's you know, it's a preoccupation. I think a lot of us are trying to steal from Le Guin, like, constantly. My next novel, which comes out in about a year, is very transparently an attempt to kind of try to copy or pay homage to some of the things that Le Guin does in this book and The Dispossessed. It's, you know, just the complexity of the politics, the fact that she creates these two different societies, each with their own complicated political system, and it doesn't feel like a lot of, like, modern epic fantasies where you would spend 100 pages just sort of describing one meal and getting all of the kind of factions and all of the kind of ideas of what's going on. She just kind of slips in all of these ideas. You understand immediately when you get to Orgarin that there are these different factions and that one of them is more kind of peaceful and trade oriented and the other is more nationalist and you know, aligned with the secret police. And it's the amount of stuff that she packs in there is really deft. It reminds me of Graham Greene, actually, who's another writer who I admire tremendously for his ability to just convey really complicated political stuff. And actually, while I'm filibustering, one thing that jumped out at me about this book this time around was the kind of subtle thread that she weaves through it about nationalism and sort of the nature of nationalism and patriotism and why you can't really be nationalistic without being a little bit paranoid and xenophobic and full of, you know, hatred of the other. And there's that wonderful passage, which is just sort of dog-eared, where, you know, Estravan says, you know, why would I hate Orgarain? You know, how does one hate a country or love one? I know people, I know towns, farms, hills, and rivers, and rocks. I know how the sun at sunset and all autumn falls on the side of a certain plowland in the hills. But what is the sense of giving a boundary to all that, of giving it a name and ceasing to love where the name ceases to apply? It's really beautiful, and it's actually super relevant right now when we're kind of in an era where nationalism and xenophobia are making a huge comeback. So I really loved that in this book.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Got your happy Priceline.
Yeah, there's so much going on. I mean, one thing that she just kind of drops as an aside towards the end is that because there are no sort of major mammals on this planet besides the human race, they have no pets. Like, they have no, like, relationship to the animal world, like the one that we have on Earth. And that just set me thinking, what's it like to grow up in a, you know, in a world where you know really there aren't any animals? I mean, there's fish, there aren't birds. That's one of the reasons why they didn't learn to create flying machines, although they have some sort of basic automobiles and similar vehicles. But, you know, even the angels in their mythology just sort of drift like snow through the sky because they don't have the idea of flight from birds. And I thought, oh God, you could write a whole novel just about what it's like not to live in a world that has never had animals in it, really.
Yeah, so much of what's inventive about this book comes out of her kind of thoughtful world building. There are a few paragraphs, again, late in the book. I think as the Arctic journey, I call it Arctic, but for the reason I'm about to describe, I don't think it would technically be called an Arctic region. But as their journey across the snow and the ice is beginning, where she just sort of casually describes the elliptic orbit of the planet and the degree to which it is or is not tilted on its axis and how that influences seasons or the lack thereof around the globe, how that's different from other planets. And it's this thing that she does really casually I'm not, you know, a planetary scientist or anything. I have no idea if it is accurate or makes sense. But it's a kind of casual version of science-forward hard science fiction that nevertheless informs all of this very subtle, thoughtful thinking about how societies would form, how history would play out. In its own way, those few paragraphs are almost as determinate in the shape of the world that she imagines here, Gethin or Winter, as the stuff around gender and biology is.
Mm, yeah. It's so incredibly rich. And then I think she wrote a few other stories set on this planet, but not a lot.
I haven't read them.
Yeah. I haven't either, but she didn't use it for another novel, I don't think. So that's kind of like she just blew it all in this one amazing book. I think for me, one of the other things that went completely over my head, in addition to the Arctic journey, which I guess just as a Southern Californian, I couldn't really picture, was, you know, as much as this is about encountering a society without real gender, it's also so much about the West's encounter with Asia. And it kind of comes out of that post-war period where you know, American companies were trying to do business with Japan, and there was all these books about how the different sort of etiquette or manner system or honor system of these Asian countries that these American businessmen were going to have to learn how to negotiate with and socialize with, and how you should never do this, but you should always do this, and it really, you know, was her background, obviously, as the daughter of anthropologists, you know, some of the most famous anthropologists of the discipline, that I think probably gave her this perspective. But it really is fascinating how much of the sort of Orientalism of the West is what Genly is projecting onto the Gethinians, you know, that there was all of the stereotypes of Asians, you know, that they are not completely manly, that they're engaged in these sort of subtle intricacies that, you know, that cannot be fathomed, that they're inscrutable, that they have this face system that you know, you have to carefully navigate, and if you go wrong, you could offend somebody, and it's really striking I think that is a strong subtext in this novel.
That's such a good point, and it speaks to the ways in which, even as she imagines the Ecumen as itself a presumably post-racial society, that this is still, in many ways, a book about racism in our own moment, which may tie back to some of what Charlie Jane was saying a few minutes ago about questions of nationalism and the virulence thereof.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's something that really struck me as well. And, you know, I was an Asian studies major in college and spent a lot of time living in Asia. And I remember hearing these kinds of conversations, especially among other Americans, about, you know, oh, face, and like, if you lose face, or how do you, you know, gain face, and like all these complicated, you know, and it's true certainly that Japanese society has a lot of that their customs and ways of communicating are different than ours, and that it takes a lot of time to get used to. But that's also something that gets kind of turned into a mystique, I think, for Westerners. And there's a whole, especially there used to be a whole industry of turning that into a kind of ongoing mystique and sort of mystification. I also thought it was interesting that, you know, there's this sort of cliche among white people, I guess, that, you know, Inuit people have like 100 words for snow. And, you know, she totally plays into that in this novel. We're constantly hearing about all the different words for snow. And I kept thinking, oh, wow, this was written during the era when everybody said, oh, they've got 100 words for snow. You know, that was like a thing.
Yeah.
I actually found myself wondering if Le Guin had inadvertently invented that cliche And people had sort of extrapolated back from her. So I don't think that she did, but
I'm sure she was riffing on that.
Yeah. Though that's certainly been true in other circumstances, that some actually sort of clever thing she would say would get twisted into just a lame-o truism that is actually false in other circumstances. She writes about that a little in her essays, which are quite delightful.
Let's talk a little bit about religion in this novel, because that it's one of the more, I think, sort of impenetrable aspects of it. But the Handara, which are sort of like Taoist or Buddhist, roughly, I don't know. It's a very, very rough parallel. That's the religion of Karhide, and then Orgeraine has the Yomesta. You can tell I'm reading this from my notes, which is like a younger religion that has a prophet who left the earlier religion, and this new religion is sort of organized around the revelations of this prophet. But you know, Taoism really was such an important thing to Le Guin. You can see it in this novel, definitely in The Wizard of Earthsea, which is probably the most familiar. That novel and the novels that came afterwards are probably the most familiar to the largest number of readers. You know, the whole revelation of that book was that the villain was just a manifestation of the hero. You know, do you see other ways, Charlie Jane, especially since you have spent so much time in Asia, do you see other aspects of Left Hand of Darkness that show that influence in her life?
I was certainly fascinated by the fortune-telling ritual that Genli Ai visits, you know, early on in the book, where you know, he goes to visit this community of fortune tellers who, you know, will ask a price and then tell you the answer to a question, which feels very much like the Greek oracle, but also very much like the ways in which you can visit a temple in Asia and get your fortune told, you know, which often involves a lot of complicated processes. Like you have a bundle of sticks, and you shake them until one of the sticks is longer, and then you get a poem, and the poem kind of gives you the answer to your question.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a whole complicated, I've witnessed it. I haven't really done it. I found that really fascinating. I think that, you know, I mean, the idea of you and your shadow, which is what Shif Grethor is.
Yeah.
I was reading up on this last night because I was curious to see what people have said about it. It is sort of a Taoist idea of like light and shadow being one, and that, you know, the Cathenians are obsessed with, you know, not having that dualism of light and shadow, of kind of bringing them together, which is something that's challenging for humans to, or people from Earth to understand.
Or at least for Genli.
Yeah, at least for Genli. Yeah.
Well, he does draw the yin and yang symbol, so he's sort of aware of it, but it just takes him forever. It just takes so long for it to get through his head that it's
yeah.
Really...
I
understand your impatience, but I do think that he's supposed to be like the average, you know, avatar of the average reader. It's just that the average reader has like surpassed him by so much by now that he seems kind of backwards.
I was just struck this time by how often he uses effeminate as like an insult. He, you know, it's one of his favorite things to call people that he doesn't like.
Yeah. And at one point he said, I can't even remember what he was making this observation, but you know, he said something like, and this makes the Gathinians like animals or like women. But then
right.
He says, unlike, you know, the people of my, unlike men or ants, which was another weird, weird analogy. Like you think of women, animals or women, you know, and then men or ants. I remember just pausing at that point and going, I wonder what he's trying to get at there, you know, because it first seems like an insult to women, but then maybe it's better to be like animals than ants. It's hard to say.
It is strange reading science fiction of this era of the 60s and of the 70s by writers that were generally progressive, thoughtful, often even radical, like Le Guin, like Samuel R. Delaney, whose Trouble on Triton I mentioned earlier, maybe even like Joanna Russ, whose book The Female Man also plays with gender and its instability in interesting ways. There is still in many of these texts a tendency to essentialize certain gendered qualities that sometimes seems to be coming from the characters and sometimes does seem to be coming from the writers themselves. And it does make, in our own moment, it often makes these once progressive texts feel here and there like artifacts of an alien culture almost, yeah. Albeit one that we recognize more than we might the societies of the Athenians.
I was struck anew by how essentializing this text is in terms of, you know, kind of conflating sex and gender and the idea that, you know, they are defined by this, their sexuality in a way that, you know, most of us would not really want to be defined by our sexuality in the 21st century. That it is a little bit like trying to kind of pin people down based on their role in sex and reproduction and in this sort of the idea that comes back to how they're sort of male unless they sort of become female for brief periods, at least as Janley sees them. So yeah, it is very essentializing.
His big breakthrough comes when he's out on the ice with Estevan and he looks at Estevan and it's like the moment where they're the closest and he sees and accepts the woman in him. You know, he sees them as male because that's the only kind of person that he feels able to deal with, you know, who's like a responsible, rational person that he can deal with. So if these are the people that he needs to negotiate with or to talk with about the ecumen, he's going to decide that they're male. but they don't see themselves that way, obviously. And it's only when he's able to actually see who Estevan is that the final barrier between them is broken down. And it's all within him.
I think I have that passage here, if that's helpful.
Yeah, please.
And I saw then again, and for good, what I had always been afraid to see and had pretended not to see in him, that he was a woman as well as a man. Any need to explain the sources of that fear vanished with the fear. What I was left with was, at last, acceptance of him as he was. Until then, I had rejected him, refused him his own reality. There's a real kind of knotted and precise quality to the way that those sentences are constantly turning back on one another, a way in which at that moment, I think, as never before, Gently is reconsidering his own sense of himself based on his ability to see the other in its otherness, that I don't quite know what to do with, but it's a compelling achievement from Le Guin that she makes that confusion and revelation play out as one at the level of her own language, I think.
It seems very much to be what, as a feminist woman, you would want a man, how you would want a man to be able to see you, you know, as a person who was also a woman, not as a person whose womanness is irrelevant, you know, but as you know, in the richness of your identity. And that's kind of what hit me then. It was such a pure expression of that desire of the person who has been made to feel like, well, I can sort of see you as a person as long as I just don't think about this one aspect of you, you know, which is the classic thing with like the person who's racist but has one black friend. It's like you're not like all the other black people or whatever.
And it is telling too that Jenly goes immediately from that revelation to thinking like, okay, but like, what if we fucked? And
right. Oh,
and like, even if it's just to negate it, this phrase is also quite striking. For us to meet sexually would be us for us to meet once more as aliens. He's saying like, okay, we're not going to do it, but like, but you can tell he's kind of going like, What if we did? Like,
I mean, do you think you it is this thing that you're thinking the whole time because you know?
Yeah,
that,
like, are they going
to
fuck?
Yeah, this novel right. is going to be. And I had actually remembered them as hooking up.
Yeah.
You know,
I thought that they had sex. I was kind of surprised that they didn't. I was even talking to my friend about it the other day, and it was like, "Yeah, they have sex, don't they?" And it's like, "Actually, no." And it was like, "Really?" Because we all remembered them having had sex.
Isn't that weird?
It is weird, but I have to just point out that, like, just 10 pages before that beautiful moment where he finally does see Estevan as male as well as female as well as male, there's that whole passage where he's explaining to Estevan about women and explaining that women, it's, you know, that your gender in most societies determines your every aspect of your life. And that, you know, women do most of the child rearing and that they don't tend to become mathematicians or composers of music or inventors of abstract thinkers. But it isn't they're stupid, he says. he's like has to like, yeah. No, it's not, I don't think they're stupid. It's just that they're not willing. They're not able to do anything that requires abstract thought. And that's like 10 pages before that moment. So it's not like he suddenly becomes... You know,
I did find myself thinking about, I mean, because, of course, you know, Le Guin, besides herself being a tremendous abstract thinker, you know, had a mother who was an accomplished anthropologist, you know, knew many great and accomplished women. I mean, I don't think that we are meant to take this as her own thinking, but rather as an extrapolation out from the way that she sees our society thinking. There are moments where... I wondered whether she'd been reading Simone de Beauvoir's Second Sex while thinking about this book or if she was thinking about them in relation to one another, because so much of it, including, of all things, some of Estevan's reflections on what it means to have your genitals outside of you and what advantages or disadvantages that might bring seem strikingly resonant with that kind of mid-century feminist theory that she might have been processing in this moment.
I know I keep going back to this, but I think that she was a novelist who was just acutely sensitive to her audience. And up until the end of her life, she felt very stigmatized as a genre writer, even though even as she was more and more honored and her genius more and more recognized, she never really lost the sense of being kind of an outsider because of the genre she chose to write in. And also she had early life experiences writing, you know, more traditional literary fiction and having that not work. And then, you know, she, in a way, as a woman science fiction writer in that time period, she was explaining something alien to a predominantly, you know, male community. And so, you know, I just consistently see him, like the whole thing about the abstract thinking. Like at one point, I remember I read an interview with her where she sort of, you know, described like the classic reader of science fiction as being, you know, white male and probably an engineer. And that was who she was speaking to. So she created this guy and then she basically broke him down, you know?
Right.
You know, to the point where he was finally forced to acknowledge that someone could be a woman and a full human being at the same time. and you know, she just, it was just such a constant uphill battle for her, I think. She, you know, but this novel was really celebrated and people recognized its genius early on. One thing that I also found, and this is kind of a weird side issue, but I just remember this from my childhood, you know, going to used bookstores and finding all of these old paperbacks, science fiction and fantasy novels from the 60s. You know, the obsession with telepathy feels so much of that time.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And I don't know what that is. And I was wondering, Charlie Jane, if you had any thoughts on that, because you probably know the genre as well as any of us, like why that would be a particular obsession during the 60s and 70s.
I mean, it was the era of ESP. It was the era of, you know, all of these mentalists and, you know, spoonbenders and, you know, all of that stuff. And yeah, it's funny reading this book now, the stuff about mind speech, telepathy just feels kind of extraneous. And it feels like it's just kind of added in as like an extra cool thing to have in the book. It doesn't feel like it comes out of the narrative at all. And Genly seems like a completely regular person who's not particularly enlightened in most ways, except that he has telepathic powers. And it's kind of weird. It's the year of Stranger in a Strange Land, which I think has all sorts of trippy mental stuff too.
I do think it serves a narrative function here, though, which is that it maybe too easily allows her to map the building emotional connection between Genly and Estravan as they're out on the ice and the snow and sledging their way across the land.
Right.
The fact that in this mind speech, and for the listener at home, we are the three of us doing mind speech here, and we're having a completely separate conversation that you are not party to.
From three different cities, yeah.
Yeah. But the fact that when they first make that connection that he mishears the mind voice or whatever you would call it of Genly as the voice of his dead sibling, Farum, it's a cool moment. And I won't say it's not earned, but because it makes their budding intimacy that much more materially real, even if it's this immaterial thing. I think it's a sort of science fiction-y way to help us see that they have bridged some of their differences, even if they're not all the way there yet.
And
right,
I guess telepathy at that time had a kind of scientific veneer on it. Like, you know, I can remember feeling vaguely as like a teenager that it was sort of being tested or proven or something.
Right.
You know, like it had a kind of it was on a kind of threshold between you know, fantasy or legend and science, and obviously a really cool thing. But I can remember my second grade teacher wrote science fiction novels that all involved telepathy, and she was really into Andre Norton, who wrote all these novels that had telepathy in them, it feels so weirdly dated now. I mean, I guess what's weirder about it is just that it's not a preoccupation of the present at all of science fiction now. I mean, maybe you would get science fiction about people being able to go into other people's dreams, but the telepathy motif seems to have completely fizzled out.
I wonder if that's at least partially because our own ability to communicate with one another across distances is now so much more varied, so much more immediate, and so much more intense that when we can, in an era when we can video chat with one another or something like that, the kind of things that make the communication done via the Ansible, this intergalactic communications device that Genly uses, make that, apart from its magical qualities, seem kind of primitive. Maybe telepathy no longer feels as urgent to us in 2018 as it did 50 some years ago to science fiction writers and readers.
What do you think Le Guin's legacy has been in the genre? I mean, she has a larger literary legacy, but in particular in the genre. How, you know, you went through this period of reading all of her work. How did she influence you? What in particular, you know, that you do or that other people, other writers are doing, how was that shaped by what she did?
I mean, to me, what I think of as like her impact on the field overall is this attention to the complexities of societies and the meanings of different cultures and also the moral complexity of people kind of navigating these complicated situations and making terrible mistakes the way Genly does throughout this book and the way so many of her characters do. And she kind of took a genre that sometimes was prone to, you know, a little bit more of a Manichaean dualism or a little bit more of a kind of a simpler approach to society in which the technology and the science were front and center, but the ideas of society and folklore and culture and history were kind of more in the backdrop. And she brought those things into the foreground and really made them, helped to make them a key subject of science fiction, which they remain to this day.
And personally, what's her influence been on you?
I mean, I think it, again, some of that same stuff. The fact that she's able to create such complex societies and characters who feel so vivid and real and are not instantly, you know, right about everything is something that I really struggle towards. And I, you know, I keep wanting to write more books in which there is that level of complexity and a feeling of a lived-in society that didn't start existing 5 seconds before you open the page, that it has a deep history. It's really hard to do, especially without kind of being heavy-handed. And nobody has really done it quite as well as she has, I think.
Mm. When Le Guin died a few weeks ago, I wrote a little essay for Slate about her way of understanding the future. And it's one that I think squares with the way that she talks about what the future is to a science fiction writer, to her at least, in the introduction to my copy of Left Hand of Darkness, which is that it's about a kind of preoccupation with the present, with what we are living now. Her approach to alienation, and an approach that always passes through the familiar, as in one bit when she talks about, when she has Jen Lee describe himself wilting like a radish leaf. And reading that, I thought, when was the last time I thought about a radish leaf? You know, I think about radishes all the time, but I don't think about radish leaves. And that willingness to show us how strange our own moment is, our own world is, by creating these elaborate elsewheres and elsewhens is such a gift. And even if the books don't always feel quite as urgent now as they may have 50 years ago, they still feel hugely important to me. She's just such a marvelous writer and thinker and creator. There was no one like her.
I think we all feel this way. And so while the audiobook club traditionally winds up with a, you guys, is it a thumbs up or a thumbs down? I think.
It's a thumbs down for me. After everything I've said, I think this book is garbage. Don't read it.
I think I can speak for the whole panel in saying it's probably a thumbs up. But if anybody wants to qualify that. Well, that's it for this month's episode of the Audiobook Club. Thank you, Jacob, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure to talk to you both about this wonderful book.
And thank you, Charlie Jane Anders, for joining us.
It was absolutely my pleasure. I had a blast. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Audiobook Club. If you like this show, check out El Gabfest en Español, Slate's first Spanish language podcast. It's led by the award-winning Mexican journalist and broadcaster, Leon Krause. The hosts, all leading Latino journalists, discuss the news of the week in a no-holds-barred lucha libre. They focus on U.S. politics and current events, but they also take on international news as well as sports and culture. And for Slate Plus listeners, there's an English language segment so that non-Spanish speakers can hear at least some of the panelists' thoughts. Check out El Gabfest en Español every Thursday morning. You'll find the show pages for this and every episode of the Audiobook Club at slate.com/ABC. Please subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, which helps other people discover the show. This podcast was produced and edited by Benjamin Frisch. For Jacob Brogan and Charlie Jane Anders, I'm Laura Miller. Thanks for listening.